Minnesota Court of Appeals. I can see both attorneys on screen for our next matter. We have a total of six matters on our calendar today. We're at the second of our three oral arguments, and we're proceeding via Zoom. For the purposes of keeping a good recording, I will ask the marshal to call the second case on our calendar.
Calling 823-0698 in the matter of Ariana Williams and OBO minor child appellant versus Santo Che Zarate respondent.
All right, and again, I'll just make a couple of quick remarks before we go ahead with the argument in this case. First of all, I just want to acknowledge that we are proceeding today, as indicated in the notice, via Zoom. This court does maintain an oral recording of today's proceedings. No other recordings are allowed, and that audio recording is later posted on the court's website. And for that reason, as well as others, we ask you, before you start your remarks, to please identify yourself as well as the client you represent. And then you'll want to have on your screen a clear indication of the clock. It should show 15 minutes right now, and you'll want to keep your eye on that. We very much enjoy the conversation with the attorneys, appreciate all of your preparation and your submissions, but the time goes quickly. So if you'd keep an eye on that. And with that, we're ready to hear from you. Counsel for appellant, please go ahead.
Good. Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Susan Yeager, and I represent the appellant, Ariana Williams, and her daughter, Ava. We're here today for three reasons: CAN, C-A-N, collateral estoppel, abuse, the Domestic Abuse Act in particular, and de novo review. First off, the court checked the box that said, no, we didn't prove the petition, and then went on in the transcript and stated that it was collateral estoppel, that throwing a pop can at the mother's head while she was holding the child.
I saw a lot of things in your brief, a lot of assertions of fact. And then I looked at the record and I didn't see support for it. So you say he threw a pop can at her head. Can you quote the transcript support for that statement?
He threw the pop can at her head. She might not have said head, but she...
saying head?
Well, I'm saying head because my client told me head.
Well, that's not in the record.
Very good, Your Honor, and I appreciate that. So he threw the pop can at her and the child, and there was pop all over. She could not remember the date.
I don't know that it says he threw the pop can at the child.
No, he threw the pop can at the mom. She was holding child, and pop got on both mom and child.
Right. Now, you keep referring in your brief to the pop can assault, but if I look at her testimony, she says he threw the can of pop at her. And she says that the pop went on her. I didn't see anything in the transcript where she testified that he hit her with the can, only that the pop went on her. Am I correct?
You're correct, Your Honor, but I would say that the Domestic Abuse Act does not say throwing a can of pop, whether the can hits you or only the liquid, constitutes abuse. This is a civil Domestic Abuse Act. It's bodily injury, bodily harm, or assault. It's not whether it's liquid, whether it's an acid, whether it's ricin, if it's just in the air. We're talking an assault under the Domestic Abuse Act.
Well, ricin and acid, with all due respect, your brief is so full of adjectives and so short on references to facts that are in the record. I mean, to compare pop with ricin poison and acid is sort of emblematic of your brief. And I have to tell you that I had a hard time getting through your brief. It was very compelling until I looked at the record.
I guess there's not a question there other than you don't like my writing.
No, it's not that I don't like your writing. It's that you're exaggerating. You're making statements of fact that aren't supported in the record. And that's not what an appellate lawyer is supposed to do.
Okay. So let's look at the collateral estoppel issue. Again, as the justice is saying, the record is what it is. I did not offer the 2017 petition, the 2017 transcript, or the 2017 decision into this court's record. So the evidence below has nothing about the 2017 assault. The court on its own decided that the 2017 pop was already decided in 2017 because although the mother testified, she couldn't remember the date that it happened, only that her child was in a car seat. The court went ahead and assumed it had to have happened previous to 2017.
Why would it assume that? Your brief suggests that, well, it must have happened 2 years ago because it was 8 years old. That's how old a child is in a car seat. But your client's testimony said that she was getting the child out of the truck. So I'm assuming an eight-year-old doesn't need a mother to get her out of a truck if in fact the child was eight. I didn't see anything in the record to suggest that it was an eight-year-old child, except for your representation.
The problem is the mother testified, I don't know the date. So I don't know getting a child out of a truck, whether the truck is a big truck or just a regular pickup. I don't know. I don't know is what the mother testified to. The court assumed that
counsel,
it must have happened before 2017.
You don't mind. Counsel, mm-hmm. If you don't mind, I think I understand your collateral estoppel argument. I think you're telling us that you're concerned that the district court made a collateral estoppel ruling without the underlying basis for it. You know, in other words, we don't, as you started your remarks, you said it accurately, this record does not include the 2017 petition, the 2017 order on the OFP, also doesn't include a transcript from those proceedings. And I believe that's accurate. So I understand the gist of your argument. I guess what I'm struggling with, this is the district court's decision not to issue an order for protection following an evidentiary hearing. And our standard of review is abuse of discretion. So even if the district court had found the facts that, as you suggest them to be, I don't see where it was an abuse of discretion to deny the order for protection. Is that there's still a number of factors that a district court can weigh in deciding whether to issue it. So I guess what I'm asking you to do is let it just assume we understand and agree with you on the collateral estoppel issue. It doesn't really suggest to me, at least not to sitting here right now, that the district court abused its discretion. So help me understand that.
Certainly. So the courts do look at the totality of the circumstances in making the decision. So as opposing counsel suggested in his brief, it's not just one act of domestic assault. It can be one act. However, there's more to it.
And can you list all of the acts of domestic assault that your client testified to?
Well, we have the denial of parenting time, which she brought a motion in October of 2022.
Oh, assault, domestic assault, domestic assault. What are the domestic assault actions that your client testified to? I saw in the transcript that I think you were counsel, you were leading her, and you said, Ms. Williams, has the respondent ever hit you, strangled you, thrown a plate at you? And she said, well, there was one incident about the pop can. So what did she testify to as the assaults that you're saying were replete?
Well, assault is not the only standard of abuse. According to 518.01, it's also fear. Fear of imminent harm. And that is also constitutes abuse.
Well, not fear. It has to be. It's an action that results in fear. So I'm wondering, what was the testimony of your client that supports what you just represented to us about the record being full of all of these incidents?
He showed up at her door in February of 2023. She has a confidential address. He's denied her parenting time repeatedly, that she sought compensatory parenting time. The police showed up at his door and said, court order says mom's supposed to have the child. And he refused to turn the child over in front of the child. So it's a continuing course of his conduct that has led her to be afraid. She knows his criminal background. She knows his previous charges of assault and weapons. Now, I'm not trying to expand on what's happened. I'm trying to say that the trial court did not look at the record, did not look at the course of conduct, and did not zero in on how having a confidential address and being afraid of someone when they show up makes you afraid. So I'm trying to say that in the course of this record, we have domestic abuse. It doesn't have to be, he hit me, he broke my bone. We can look at the severity in the totality of the circumstances analysis, but the statute alone doesn't say you got to break a bone for domestic abuse. You got to choke them out for domestic abuse. Certainly we can recognize when we go to the extreme and a man...
I'm not asking for extremes. I'm just asking whether there's any evidence in the record of actual abuse. And what you've described, I think, or you described your client's fear because he showed up at her house and you say that, or she said that her address was not disclosed to him, but somehow he knew her address. And therefore, that should be something that is domestic abuse. I'm not sure the case law supports that, but I'm wondering if there are any other specific incidents that you can point us to that your client testified to that would constitute abuse under the act.
Well, if we look at the case law, an overt act or assault, as the justice has questioned me about, is not required. It can be tearing up a marriage certificate or cutting it and then pushing a salesperson. The court said that is enough to institute fear of domestic assault, and the order for protection was upheld. So it doesn't take a physical assault as in a criminal proceeding. This takes just a scintilla of evidence in favor of the order for protection.
I'm asking you for what are the examples of these? You're listing things that aren't necessary to qualify. I'm asking you for what was the evidence that your client testified to that would support the finding that you believe the district court missed?
Text messages that I'm going to end you permanently, text messages that you're an incompetent mother, text messages that I'm going to take custody, making her afraid to even bring up custody, and repeated denial of parenting time, in addition to the pop can, in addition to showing up at her confidential address. Do you want me to continue?
If you have more, I certainly would.
Well, we're looking at the timing, the frequency, severity, likelihood of further abuse in the totality of the circumstances. We're not looking at the intention of the abuser, which is what some courts mistakenly looked at before. Repeatedly denying parenting time is a terroristic threat, according to the statute 518.01, subdivision 2A, 2-3, as well as the Chief Justice Gildea in the Rue versus Bergstrom dissent, where she said, yeah, denial of parenting time is kidnapping, constitutes domestic abuse. In addition, the legislature has 609.26. Deprivation of parenting rights can constitute a felony. So I think we have the seriousness of the legislative intent protect victims of domestic violence with what has actually happened here. Again, clearly there's no statute of limitation. Thompson made that clear. And there's no minimal degree of harm required in the statute. This is not a criminal assault. And it was the Bonacek case, which was the cut the marriage certificate and push the salesman for the order for protection. What we have here is
where sort of Judge Bradfold is at of how is your arguments may be compelling if we had de novo review, and how do we get past the abuse of discretion? Because we may independently say, sure, I would have granted that, but that's not our review.
Right. And I'm not asking you to overmine the court's determination of credibility. I'm asking that we have an abuse of discretion because the court went beyond the record. We have an abuse of discretion because the court misapplied the law. It's not logical that he said collateral estoppel prevents pop can information. So I guess how we get over abuse of discretion is both ways. He went beyond the record, which the court should not have gone beyond the record. He could have taken judicial notice of the 2017 transcript, the 2017 order, the 2017 petition, but he did not. I didn't offer it. Opposing counsel offered no evidence. So it's just not part of the record. I feel that that is the abuse of discretion that you were questioning me about. The evidence of the pop can further has not, she's not been given a full and fair opportunity to litigate it, which is the collateral estoppel argument, which I won't discuss because you seem all right with that. So we have the child went to a new school. Mother was not even on the school listed as a mother, and she couldn't pick up her child from school because the school said, who are you? So she had to go get the child's birth certificate. Again, it's this kind of repeated behavior that just makes it more hurdles for mom. Scheduling child activities during mom's parenting time, not giving her access to the therapy records or activities, it makes it, again.
These sound like excellent arguments for significant decisions to be made in the family court about parenting time and about access to children. I'm not sure, at least for my, I don't speak for the court, but I'm not sure it convinces me that this amounts to an abuse of discretion for the court not to then issue an order for protection for these things in the custody dispute.
My time's out.
So, counsel, Judge Ross, do you want to have that answer now? Or
yes, I am sure.
Yeah, go ahead. Yep, counsel, go ahead.
Yes, we do have the custody matter going on, and it's been going on for 10 years, and it's the same judge as heard the order for protection. And in the custody order, we've asked for compensatory parenting time. We've had one day of trial, and we've got a second day scheduled in 5 days. So that is continuing. I'm not sure that mother's going to be given a fair opportunity to let the court know her fears, her emotions, because the court's decided that it doesn't matter. And again, the legislative intent is to protect victims of abuse, not to just kick the can down the road.
Right.
Again, time.
No, thank you very much for responding to Judge Ross's question. We appreciate that. You do know, I think, that you have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you decide to use them. Okay. So with that, we have reset the clock for the respondent, and we are ready to hear from you, Mr. Hamilton.
Thank you. May it please the court, my name is Michael G. Hamilton of the Hastings Law Firm of Tanner & Hamilton, PA. I represent the respondent in this appeal, Santo Shea Zarate, who's also the respondent in the trial court case, which, as the court knows, is a domestic abuse proceeding by appellant Arianna Lynn Williams, both on her own behalf and on behalf of the minor child of the parties, against Mr. Zarate. Now, specifically, the appellant has appealed the domestic abuse order for dismissal of the Honorable Jepal J. Harris, judge of Ramsey County District Court, which was filed with the trial court on April 10 of 2023, dismissing the domestic abuse case pursuant to my oral motion at the conclusion of appellant's case in chief at trial, based upon the lack of evidence of domestic abuse. And in the order, Judge Harris found that the allegations of the petition were not proven, that there was insufficient evidence of domestic abuse to support an order for protection.
You agree that the district court did not have access to the 2014 and 2017 proceedings?
I do, Your Honor.
So what would be the basis for the district court reaching the apparent conclusion, whether the court applied collateral estoppel or not, that this was a matter that had already been addressed in a previous order for protection proceeding?
Yeah, I think what the court did, and I hate to speak for Judge Harris, because I'm not sure exactly what his thought process was, but he took an incident that occurred before the 2017 hearing, and the appellant did testify that it occurred 7 or 8 years ago, so 2015 or 2016, which would have preceded the 2017 domestic abuse hearing, and that she either did or should have raised that as one of the circumstances under the totality of the circumstances in the 2017 domestic abuse hearing.
Well, when you say did raise it or should have raised it, I mean, the case law is pretty clear on this point, isn't it? I mean, whether you agree with it or not, the Supreme Court has established that there's really no limit to how far back you can look at incidents that might support an order for protection?
I do agree when it's actual physical harm, bodily injury, or assault, that when it's fear of imminent physical harm, bodily injury, or assault, it has to be something more recent under the statute. But under that first prong of domestic assault, there is no statute of limitations, or you don't draw the line in the sand as far as how far back it goes. But certainly you can take that into consideration when you're looking at the totality of the circumstances. And I think the fact that she didn't testify to anything really since that incident from 7 or 8 years ago really goes to show that the court did not abuse its discretion. And there's an issue as to whether or not that was even domestic assault as it was testified to by the appellant. What she said, here's what her testimony was. She said, there was one incident where he did assault me with a can of pop during an exchange. I was there to take my daughter. He threw the can of pop at me and it got all over me, all over my daughter. She was very young at the time. And then I followed up asking her when this occurred and asked if it occurred 7 or 8 years ago, and she affirmed that it did. So it certainly was an older incident. I'm not even going to call it domestic abuse because she didn't testify that the can hit her, that there was any physical harm, bodily injury, or assault by virtue of the can being thrown. And that's really what her burden is to show domestic abuse, if she's going to rely on an incident that occurred that long ago. I think it's also very important to note, and I'm quoting her testimony once again. She said, I never said that my fear was a physical fear. It's my fear of mental, emotional, and could be physical, but there's no evidence of that. So she's testifying that there's no evidence. She doesn't have any evidence of any domestic abuse based on physical harm, bodily injury, or assault. And she's talking about mental and emotional, what she calls mental and emotional abuse, which is not domestic abuse as it's defined by statute. So I think, again, you're looking at...
Oh, counsel, if I may, I think that piece of testimony is an important part of your argument. And it seems to me that if we do view this for abuse of discretion and view it in favor of the district court's finding of no proof of allegations, we would agree with you. I think that's a little bit different from what you just argued, which is you seem to be arguing that as a matter of law, that statement means that there was no domestic abuse. And I'm not sure that those aren't exactly the same things. And the district court found that the proof did not sustain the allegation of abuse.
Your Honor, I completely agree with the court. I'm just quoting her testimony. This is what the court relied upon in dismissing the case. And as the court's alluded to previously, the testimony was very scant. The evidence was very scant of domestic abuse. She said in her petition that my client physically abused the party's daughter, which would be domestic abuse if proven. And she also alluded to the denial of her court-ordered parenting time by Mr. Zarate, which in itself is not domestic abuse. Through her testimony and evidence, she put in absolutely no evidence of any physical abuse of the child. She didn't even go there at the hearing. So again, she didn't prove any of the petitions that were stated in her petition. And when the court found that the allegations of the petition weren't proven, that is an accurate finding because they weren't proven. The alleged pop can incident wasn't stated in the petition. That was outside of the petition. So.
And of course, she's not limited to the allegations, the petition at the time of the evidentiary hearing, right?
I understand that, Your Honor. Yeah.
So I was wondering if you were going to go on and talk about the other instances that appellant's counsel is arguing. So, for instance, the repeated denial of parenting time as sufficient to sustain perhaps a terroristic threat or fear of imminent harm, depending on the other circumstances.
I don't think under any stretch of the imagination, when you look at the court's definition of terroristic threat, that the denial of parenting time, and again, my client denies that he has denied parenting time, and that's subject to the evidentiary hearing in the family court case, where we're going to continue next Monday. I don't see how you can stretch that out and say that the denial of parenting time, even if it's proven or believed, is an actual terroristic threat. You know, terroristic threat has to do with violence. take a look at the statute. So I don't believe that that could be construed as a terroristic threat. Plus, again, through her testimony, she may have stated something in her petition, but I don't think through her testimony that she sustained that she's been denied parenting time. With respect to the confidential address, I think her claim is that my client...
I thought she had argued, and I know this was in the brief, I thought it was in the transcript also, that the police were called out numerous times on parenting time disputes. Was that only assertions of counsel, or is that also a matter of record evidence?
I do believe she testified as to one time where the police were called and sent to my client's residence, and was kind of left at that. She wasn't there at the residence. She couldn't testify as to what happened at the residence, and she didn't put in the police report either. So you know, that might have been one incident where she's alleging that he denied her parenting time. And that's the only one that I think is in the court's record from this particular hearing. Now, with respect to my client showing up at her confidential address, Your Honors, my client did it responsibly. The background of that is she was supposed to return the child to my client that evening. She didn't. So my client responsibly calls the police, goes to her home with the police. He stays in his car or stands by his car while the police go to her door.
Is this in the record?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, but she's put an awful lot of things in the record, and that's why I responded in that fashion.
Well, I mean, counsel making assertions does not make it in the record, and both counsel should be aware when we decide this case, we'll be deciding it based upon what's in the record, not assertions of counsel.
I understand that, Your Honor, and that's why, if you take a look at our brief, I spent a lot of our brief or a significant portion indicating that the statement of fact in both the original brief and subsequently in the reply brief are well beyond the evidence that was presented at trial and in the court's record, or else she's mischaracterized things that are in the court's record. I'll go back again to my client going to her home unannounced with the police. And I note that opposing counsel in her brief says that that was in violation of an ex parte order for protection. And the court has been provided with the part of the court's record that shows that there was no ex parte order for protection, that it was actually denied. And she also indicates that my client went to her home only 2 days after she filed for this order for protection. But if you take a look at the affidavit of service on my client, he wasn't served with the domestic abuse paperwork until after the incident at appellant's home. He had no knowledge of the case at that time. I think it's also important to note that the appellant, to me, inexplicably relies on alleged facts from other domestic abuse cases where the OFPs were actually denied to her client. She tries to rely on those in support of the issuance of an OFP in this case. And again, despite the fact that there's absolutely no evidence addressing what happened, what was put in, the orders weren't even provided from the former order for protection cases. So again, that's another incident where she's trying to put in a lot of alleged facts that aren't a part of the court's record. So, Your Honors, I think if you take a look at it, there was no abuse of discretion by the trial court, that the evidence presented at trial fully supports the decision of the trial court not to issue an order for protection and to dismiss the case. The domestic abuse order for dismissal must be upheld and affirmed as a result. And to me, if the court would have granted the petition and issued an order for protection based on the scant evidence that was provided, I'd be here arguing that the court abuses discretion in issuing an order for protection based on the evidence that was produced at trial. So again, I think if you throw out everything that's said in their brief that's outside of the court's record, you're left with the alleged pop can throwing incident and when he showed up at her house. And she didn't even testify that him showing up at her house was intended or did inflict any fear of imminent physical harm, bodily injury, or assault to her. That's not in her testimony. All she said was he showed up at my house without going any further and indicating how that corresponded with domestic abuse. Again, going back to the pop can incident, I don't think that on its face.
I mean, I think I understand your argument, okay. But I just want you to, you know, directly respond to what appellant argues, which is it isn't merely that your client showed up at the house, but that there had been some care taken to maintain confidentiality of Ms. Williams' address. And apparently exchanges were happening at a different location. So there, you know, because all of this depends on the facts and circumstances proven at an evidentiary hearing, it's important to represent the record accurately. It's just, it's all I'm asking you to do. So do you want to respond to that argument?
And I agree, Your Honor, that it's all based on the court's record. And if you take a look at our brief, that's what I expound on. But I still felt the need to respond to some of the things that she stated that maybe were outside of the court's record. But I'm happy if the court just looks at the record, takes everything else that's stated in our briefs out, and makes its decision as to whether or not the trial court abuses discretion based on only the evidence that was presented at trial.
Well, our court rules do require us to limit our analysis to the record. So again, both counsel can be confident that we won't be considering the extraneous comments of either counsel. And I know how these cases work. You're involved with your client and you're hearing things from your client, and perhaps you confuse things that are in the record with things you've heard, but we're going to limit ourselves to the record. You can be sure of it.
Thank you, Your Honor. I know I have a little bit of time left, but that does conclude my oral argument.
Are there any questions for the panel? Okay. Thank you, counsel. So we'll go ahead and reset the clock, Ms. Yeager, to 5 minutes. And you can proceed with your rebuttal remarks when you're ready, if you'd like.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'm again going to refer the court to the Supreme Court decision, Rue versus Bergstrom, 2014. The site is 845 Northwest 2nd, 764. And this is the dissent from our Chief Justice. And it says, in addition, Rue alleged Bergstrom had threatened in part to not return the children after visitation. Threatening to kidnap the children constitutes, quote, domestic abuse, end quote, against the children under the Domestic Abuse Act, end quote. Now, and the cite there is to, as I said, the Domestic Abuse Act 518B.01 sub 2A2-3. And
were either of the parties in this case ever accused or charged or convicted with kidnapping?
No, Your Honor, when police officers went to his door and he denied the turning over the child of Ava, that's when the police issued a warrant for his arrest. I believe it was a few hours, like maybe 48 or 72. I'm not sure.
Are you describing what's in the record or is this outside the record?
This is outside. And stick to
what's in the record. I mean, I don't want to use up your time talking about things that we're just not going to be able to consider.
Okay. Well, we have brought up that we've been denied parenting time again and again and again. As counsel is aware, she's got her compensatory parenting time in, and it was even testified to when we were in front of the judge that she's been denied what mom's calculated to be 4 years of parenting time. So there's a substantial amount of parenting time. I'm saying that the Supreme Court says that's terroristic threats and constitutes domestic abuse. So we have the physical bodily injury part, and we have the fear of imminent bodily injury. And I also wanted to say that there's nothing in the statute that says intent of the abusive person. We're looking at the physical assault, the fear of imminent physical assault, or the terroristic threats. Mom has proven the pop can. I'm not going to go back and forth on that, but I don't think there's anything in our domestic abuse statute that says the severity of the harm has to be she has a concussion. It's got to be like she's playing football out there and really got knocked down. It doesn't say that.
Again, you put these extremes. The record is talking about a soft drink that splashed on your client and the child, according to your client's testimony. And you're right, it's not a concussion, but it's also just a soft drink. And the district court, whether we like the decision or not, didn't believe that that amounted to domestic abuse.
But I think the district court was looking at that too narrowly and not looking at all the other information that mom testified to. She knows he's a felon. He's been convicted of assault, weapons charges. She's known him for 15 years. She's known about his previous marriage. So again, denying parenting time is abuse, according to the Supreme Court. And I don't think the judge applied the law correctly. He misapplied the law, which is an abuse of discretion, not only as to the collateral estoppel argument, but also as to what constitutes domestic abuse. Our statute is clear. We can look at the circumstances of severity, but it doesn't say it has to be this level of severity. It doesn't say pop is not an assault. I understand if you feel that it's just pop, it's spilled milk, we shouldn't get excited about that. But here's the thing. If I held a hammer up above you and I didn't even say anything, are you going to stop what you're doing and address the hammer above your head or not? It doesn't have to be an explicit threat to be a threat. We look at the totality of the circumstances. What does this man continue to do for the life of this child? 10 years. They've been exchanging in a police parking lot unless one parent just gets the child at school. After 10 years, we still can't get these parents to cooperate to raise the child in their best interests. Because mom's afraid. Mom's afraid to even bring up, I want custody, because of the past experiences she's had with dad. And I realize my time's short. I'm asking for the order for protection to protect this woman and her child. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. Our thanks to both attorneys in this case. The matter is now submitted to this court for a decision, and we will issue a written decision within this statutory timeframe.